I was born in Tampa, Florida, back in the late 70s, 77 to be exact. And I grew up in a place called Central Park Village. Central Park is a lot different than, you know, the Central Park that people might be used to hearing about in New York City. It's filled with, you know, violence, drugs, and prostitution, and just things that a child shouldn't have to, you know, be forced to grow up around. But I was. And I come from a family of a single mother home. Nobody in the household but me and my older brother and my mom. But I also had a grandmother named Linda who loved me like her next breath, and she treated me very special. But when she moved back to Georgia, due to old age and having to go to a nursing home, I was unable to take care of her because I was a little boy. And soon after she moved back to Georgia, I started getting in trouble with the law. And by the age of 13, I found myself charged with attempted murder, doing a robbery attempt. And I was shortly after placed in Hillsborough County Jail. And soon after that, I was sentenced for the rest of my life in prison due to, the judge looking at me as a grown man instead of the little child I was.
Tell me of that feeling. I mean, a lot of people see it on TV or hear it on the news or on their social media, but what is it like to actually be standing in front of the judge and hearing that sentence? How do you feel? What was your reaction?
Great question. So, I had just turned 14, like 13 days prior. So, I couldn't fully comprehend what he meant when he said life. I assumed that the life sentences he was talking about were 20 years each, and so I distinctly remember, hugging my mom for the last time. I say the last time because, she never gave me a visit. So the last time I touched her was when the judge sentenced me to life. But I went back to the holding cell, and it was a guy in the holding cell, just one other guy that I grew up with, and he asked me, what did they do? And I told him, man, they gave me 40 years. So I couldn't fully comprehend, but even 40 years to a kid is forever, not to mention that my attorney had promised that I would not receive no more than 15 years if I pled to guilty. So I couldn't fully comprehend life, but I thought that the 40 years he gave me was a life sentence. And it's just it was a terrible feeling, and I remember crying because I didn't cry that much throughout my lifetime. So it's almost like I could pinpoint every time I cried. And I just remember the feeling of sadness that it was a strong possibility that I would never see Tampa, Florida again.
Talk about how whenever you went to prison, you decided to pick up the phone and call Debbie, which is the person that was shot during the robbery attempt. And, you kind of chatted with her. I guess, what was your first thought when you pick up the phone? I mean, do you think she's actually going to receive the call?
Great question. So, I've always had a big, very big imagination. It is what has sustained me my whole life. It allowed me to, check out, numb out, as well as give myself hope. So, I can tell you exactly some of the things that went through my mind. I felt she was going to pick up. I willed her to pick up, so to speak. Like, I envisioned her picking up. It's all about the intention you set. And my intention was that I was going to call this lady and that, she was going to pick up the phone. And that, once she picked up the phone, that I would be able to just go off from the heart and the head and tell her exactly how I felt about shooting her when I was 13 years old, a year earlier. But while the phone was ringing, the thing I distinctly remember the most was before the operator picked up, I envisioned two voices in my head, like saying, pretend like it's the officer calling. Pretend like it's the detective that was working the case. Cause I had just read that name in my transcripts as well. But then it was another side saying, no, Ian, if this is going to work, you have to be honest. You have to say who you are and not that you're a detective. But when you're 14 and got a big imagination, you think if you say it's the detective that she will be more likely to accept the call. But what you don't think is, why would a detective be calling her Colette? You know what I'm saying? So I ended up just going with my heart and telling the operator it was a Colette call from Ian. But even that wasn't good enough. I stepped out on a limb of courage and had to even step even further because Debbie said, could you ask him his last name? And so I had to go all the way out there on the limb of courage and just say, tell him Emmanuel. My last name's Emmanuel. And she said, yes. Yes, I accept. And so we started talking. And that's the beginning of the story.
How will you describe that time in prison? You know, at this point you're corresponding with Debbie and you know, you've been there since you were really young. So what was it like to get used to and adapt to that life?
That's the thing. I don't think I ever adapted to life on the inside, meaning so I'm like a chameleon, so I can basically blend in anywhere but not be fully there. If I would have wholeheartedly taken on prison, I would have become institutionalized. So I had to keep my mind free, and that's the one thing I did through my poetry. When I was in prison, I was placed in solitary confinement, which is a big part of the story that many people don't know that will come out of my memoir. I spent 18 consecutive years in solitary, and while I was in solitary, writing poetry really helped sustain and helped me was a therapy. It was like that's how I healed myself because there was no real therapy in prison. So I would express my pain through my poetry. But that was in a latter part. So I was in solitary confinement from age 15 to age 33. I was in open population, maybe a year? And the first year in prison, it was different and it was difficult because I was given all the responsibilities of an adult at the age of 14 and told that, you know, in some sense I was an adult, in others I wasn't. And the sense that I was an adult was, hey, you have a life sentence, you have to be around these people, you're not going home. In the sense that I was an adult, you're 14 years old, you can buy anything in the canteen to sell tobacco products. You have to be 21 years old to buy tobacco products. And not that I even smoked. I don't smoke. I hate cigarettes. But in prison, cigarettes are like the commerce of the land. It's, make my life a little easier. But when I go to the window, that's when I was to purchase canteen and purchase a pack of cigarettes. That's when I was treated like a kid. So it was a difficult adjustment, being separated from my family, my mom, dad, even though he wasn't in my life, and just the suffering that I endured for 26 years, over the course of that time, I lost every immediate family member. People died on me, people abandoned me. It was just a very difficult upbringing, and I'll talk about it more in depth in my memoir.
After that time, and whenever, you were talking to Debbie and it was brought to the table to try to do some paperwork, and get you out of there, how do you felt, when that happened? Do you thought it was going to be possible that, you were going to be out of there?
So I was arrested in 90, and in 1993, my first appeal was filed. And I had hope. I've always had that hope, man, because if you don't have hope, hope is the sustenance to growth. It keeps us waking up every day and keeps us motivated. So yes, I did have hope that I would get out. Debbie, forgiving me was huge. But let's just be honest here. The Florida justice system didn't care that Debbie forgave me. She could have forgave me all she wanted. That was not going to get me out of prison. It took the actions of the Equal Justice Initiative by its executive director, Brian Stevenson, sending me a letter and actually taking on my case to actually get the wheels turning towards, you know, giving me some justice.
And, you know, fast forward to, you know, the hearings, the paperwork, and all of that. Tell me about your first day out. How do you felt whenever, you know, you knew you were going to get out and the day came? What happened?
That's a long process, but I'll tell you the end. I'll just tell you the end part because after I went back to the jail after the sentencing hearing, and it was basically I was waiting on a process. It was like a five-prong process of this person having to check off this box and that person having to check on out that box. And I was finally at a state in my life where there was nothing else I could do. Like, I couldn't, there was no appeal I could write. There was no one I could call. All I could do was just let go. And I've been there before, and I just want to make the connection here. I was drowning as a little kid, and a lifeguard saw me drowning. But little did I know that he saw me drowning. But while I was at the bottom of the pool and I was about to, as soon as I just let go and was about to breathe all this water in and just drink this whole pool, this lifeguard named Prince jumped in and saved my life and took me to the top. So fast forward 30 years later, I'm in this cell with my destiny out of my control, and all I could do was wait. I just let go, man. I went to sleep, man. I took two Benadryls. I'll never forget. Two Benadryl pills and went to sleep, and I woke up with an officer banging on my door telling me the words I've been waiting 26 years to hear. Man, you pack it up. You're being released. It was like I was still in the bed dreaming, because when something like that happens and you've waited your whole life for it, it literally feels like a dream. I walked out of the county jail in a daze. My social worker, Mariah Morrison, who had been hired to be that consistent person in my life, was the first person to hug me. And then we left, and me, her, and Ben, we went and met up with Debbie at a gas station and to find a place to eat. And we ended up going downtown, nearly right where the place that Debbie was shot at 26 years earlier. And we went in there in this restaurant, and we had pizza. I think Debbie and Mariah ordered vegetarian pizza. I ordered regular pizza, and Ben ordered some type of meat pizza. And I just remember tasting everyone's pizza at the table because I haven't had any street food in forever. So it was just a wonderful feeling, and I just remember kissing Debbie on both sides of her cheek once we got out of the car, because that was another dream I had in my head with my big imagination, that if I ever had a chance to be in Debbie's presence, I would hug her and kiss her on both sides of the cheek, because I didn't know what side the bullet had, you know, actually touched her on and went in. So that's something, that was my way of continuing the apology process. And we left Tampa that night, and we drove to Gainesville, and my lawyers was tired, and we went and checked into a hotel, and I got to stay in a hotel for the first time and lay in the softest bed I had ever laid in, because I had been in prison on those hard steel bunks for so many years. It was just a beautiful night. The Equal Justice Initiative has a reentry process that they individualized for each client. I went through that process, and I won't say I've mastered the process, but I'm far ahead of where I was when I first started. Now I'm living in New York City. My life is, I'm living my dreams. I'm in New York City. I'm working with kids part-time at this job as a mentor. But other than that, I'm also traveling the country speaking. I'm working on my memoir. I just came back from an audition for a play. I'm I just came back last week from a yoga retreat with two international yoga celebrities, teaching them about the criminal justice system and incorporating my poetry in the yoga classes. I'm living a life that I'm doing things that have never been done before, and it's all because I didn't give up my hope and that I believed in my mantra that I came up with in prison, and that's the impossible is obtainable. The impossible is obtainable. I repeat that to myself, and now I'm living the impossible.
A study was done in Evansville about school-to-prison pipeline and how the majority of those cases are children of color, and how differently they're treated, you know, of children that are non-of color. So can you just kind of tell me a little bit about that, since, you know, you were a child when that happened to you, and you are a person of color. So what are your thoughts on that specifically?
Well, the school-to-prison pipeline to me is just that, you know, it boils down to a little more than just the school itself. It's the environment. It's a conditioning. It's you know, the chains might have been taken off you physically from slavery, and then schools might have been desegregated, but mentally the chains are still there. It's a conditioning that comes through you, through the textbooks, through the TV, through the music, that it's psychological. And so when you are a kid and you're coming up in these environments and you're seeing the violence that surrounds you, the idiotic rap lyrics that have no substance, or the textbooks that aren't teaching you the actual truth of American history, and you have a government that is somewhat kind of promotes this, it's there, man. We need programs that support both parents and kids, and to giving them a better liability of something more, you know, because right now, without adequate jobs, it's going to keep happening because people feel like there is no other option, you know, but to, you know, commit crimes, you know. And so until there is a government that helps provide adequate jobs for the people of color and people that are poor, the school to prison pipeline is just going to keep be a revolving door throughout you and my generation. Yeah, so I will do the poem, My Time's Gonna Come. It's like three or four stanzas, and you can choose which part you want to incorporate into your interview. You ready?
Yes.
I promise you, the brunt of my oppression has a purpose, and the same person that you persecute will one day be worshipped. Though I stand before you bare-chested and shirtless, with my soul and emotions naked, just wanting to be nurtured. Yeah, despite the desperation, desertion, and hurting, my time gon' come. Though I compose this poem not knowing if I'll ever be able to perform it in an auditorium, I do it with the faith of a poet that believes he was born to do it, like an acorn caught up in a storm, flung from the branch where it was born. You can only hold me back for so long. My time don't come. Despite the difficulties and disappointments, my determination remains undaunted. Though the waters of my tomorrows are deep and uncharted, the buoyance of my character will float unwavering toward them, like a song written but unrecorded. My time don't come. Though you wrap me in chains and sprayed me with chemical flames and did all of the things you did to add to my pain, my circumstances will change. I believe this with the depths of my being, that as long as this world continues to spin, it cannot end until it's been enjoyed by end. Remember this day, because things won't always be this way. My time gon' come. My time gon' come. Against all conceivable odds, my time gon' come.